2007 through the merger of three Muslim organizations in southern India, describes itself as an outfit that works towards the achievement of socio-economic, cultural, and political empowerment of the deprived and the downtrodden and the nation at large.
Radical Hindu groups allied with India's ruling Bharatiya Janata Party had long demanded a ban on the Popular Front of India. It comes as minority Muslims in the country have in recent years complained of marginalization under the Hindu Nationalist Federal Government. The ban on the Muslim outfit and arrests of its leaders has evoked a mixed response, with some welcoming the move and others decrying it. However, it has led to unanimous calls countrywide for similar measures against radical Hindu organizations involved in crimes against Muslims.
The Popular Front of India, according to a mission statement posted on its website, seeks to establish an egalitarian society where everyone enjoys freedom, justice, and a sense of security. It claims to speak for Muslims as well as other minorities, including lower caste Dalits and tribals. However, that has not prevented the BJP government from invoking charges such as sedition, creating enmity in society, and destabilizing India against the outfit and its members. A lawyer representing the PFI was quoted as saying that the government failed to produce any evidence of the group receiving international funding for terror activities in India. The Social Democratic Party of India, a group that works with PFI but has not been included in the ban, slammed the Modi government for misusing the investigation agencies and using laws to silence the opposition and to scare the people from expressing the voice of dissent. The ban has evoked a mixed response. Asaduddin Owaisi, a leading Indian Muslim politician, said the ban on PFI cannot be supported. He argued that the way India's electoral autarky is approaching fascism, every Muslim youth will now be arrested with a PFI pamphlet under India's black law. The opposition Congress Party welcomed the ban but said the BJP's ideological parent RSS should be similarly outlawed.
When law is not applied equally on every member of the society, that really undermines the rule of law and the democracy on which it is at rest. And I think it's hurtful for democracy if an action is taken which is not just and grounded in rule of law. But having said that, that is the nature of many societies which we are witnessing. There's a heavy bias in favor of the people who are in power. They are totally unmindful of what the majority of the people really think or conduct themselves, and ordinary people really have to suffer because of that.
Now let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Mohammad Salman, president of Student Islamic Organization of India, says the ban on Popular Front of India is a worrying development for all citizens and constitutes a threat to democracy and freedom. Samiullah Khan, a journalist and activist, asserts that the ban on PFI is unjust and an attempt to cripple the Muslim community, adding that he has witnessed the Muslim outfit's humanitarian work. Senior Indian politician and parliamentarian Asaduddin Owaisi calls the ban on PFI draconian and says it is a ban on any Muslim who wishes to speak his mind.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
The Hazara Shia community in Afghanistan faced yet another colossal tragedy just recently. A suicide bomber attacked an educational institute in the predominantly Shia neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi in West Kabul, killing at least 53 people and wounding many others. No group claimed responsibility for the carnage, but the Daesh terrorist group has in the past been involved in such horrific crimes against the persecuted community, especially since the Taliban made a dramatic comeback after trouncing the US-led coalition forces last year.
On September 30th, a suicide bomber stormed a popular educational center in West Kabul's Shia-populated neighborhood of Dasht-e-Barchi, opened indiscriminate fire, and then detonated his explosives when around 400 students, mostly girls, were taking tuition for the university entrance exam. The UN assistance mission in Afghanistan said the massive explosion killed at least 53 people, including 46 girls and women, and wounded more than 110 others. The casualty figure is likely to rise further. All names need documenting and remembering, and justice must be done, the mission asserted. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack so far, but the persecuted Hazara community has often been targeted by the Daesh terrorist group, which has seen resurgence since the Taliban's comeback last year, effectively filling the vacuum left by the US-led NATO forces. The terrorist group, which has its own rivalry with the Taliban, was involved in a similar suicide attack on an education center in the same neighborhood in 2020, which killed at least 24 students. In May 2021, it carried out another devastating attack near a school in Dasht-e-Barchi, killing more than 85 people. The unchecked attacks have put added pressure on the de facto government in Kabul to ensure the safety and security of vulnerable ethnic minorities.
Amongst the harrowing scenes following the recent bombing was a grief-stricken mother mourning the death of her two young sons, a helpless father running helter-skelter in search of his missing daughter, a distraught brother waiting in a hallway for his critically injured sister to recover. With the international community maintaining a deafening silence over the Daesh carnage and the Western media willfully downplaying it, the Hazara Shia activists have in recent days taken to the streets of Kabul demanding tighter security as well as justice and accountability.
Since 2014, when Daesh terrorist group made its first inroads in the country, it has been relentlessly bombing mosques, schools and hospitals that belong to the Hazara Shia community. Dasht-e-Barchi and other smaller pockets inhabited by Shias in the Afghan capital have been turned into killing fields. Although the Taliban claim that its approach toward the ethnic minorities, including Hazara Shias, has changed, the failure to protect the community from the Daesh onslaught has drawn anger and outrage. Over the past few days, members of the Hazara Shia community have held a series of demonstrations in Kabul and other major cities, including Mazar-e-Sharif, Herat, and Bamiya, against the ongoing genocide. Slogans such as "Stop Hazara Genocide" and "It's not a crime to be a Shia" have been reverberating across the country, especially amid the deafening silence in the West. The de facto Taliban government has vowed to enhance the security of the persecuted community and send its representative to the families of the victims of Friday's bombing. In a statement, the Taliban Foreign Ministry condemned the attack as the work of malicious networks and a conspiracy by the enemies of Afghanistan to create divisions among the Afghan people. However, the victims just want justice.
Now to have more insight, we are once again joined by Mr. Mustafa Ariyayi, author at COVID Action magazine from the Netherlands. First of all, welcome to the program, Mr. Ariyayi. Now, we witnessed another devastating tragedy for the Hazara Shia minority in Afghanistan just recently. Again, the school was targeted and young children were killed. Now, why do these attacks continue to be unchecked?
Yes. First, I would like to convey my deepest condolences to the families of the martyrs. May the Almighty grant their loved ones patience and strength to overcome yet another horrible tragedy that left so many casualties. Let me tell you that the latest cascade of attack is not the first one and most likely won't be the last one. And indeed, the war has not came to an end. as opposed to what many people believe to be the case. These attacks unfortunately culminated in the killing of many innocent, young, and well-educated young boys and girls. The sworn enemy of our country won't rest until they have achieved their objective, namely the total dissolution of the state entity, and with it, the pride of its people. These attacks not only targeted Hazaras, but equally so other ethnic groups who have suffered enormously for the past four decades of war. And the carnage that was imposed upon them. Unfortunately, the suffering will continue, and the attack against Hazara and Tajiks, as well as other groups, obviously, in our country, deserve the harshest condemnation. Yet the international community of states, save for some entities, has been remarkably silent on the ongoing suffering of the Afghan nation. And that indeed emboldens terrorists. What I also would like to add is that the country is already facing a humanitarian crisis unknown in scale. Yet these leaders who were traditionally supporting the Hazara, our Hazara compatriots, did not lift a finger to support them. They live outside the country enjoying an extravagant lifestyle, which does not resonate with how the vast majority of Afghans are living right now, which is in an impoverished state while simultaneously being subjected to terrorist attacks. And furthermore, Afghan girls have been deprived from the right of education. So you can imagine what kind of a discrepancy that has brought about. And really, it's horrible.
Ms. Arya, most of these attacks targeting the persecuted Hazara Shia community in Kabul and in other Afghan cities in recent years were claimed by the Daesh terrorist group. So the question is, which powers are behind this terrorist group?
Right. I mean, let's say for what it is, there is no significant difference between old allies, the Taliban and Daesh. They derive their ideology from the same source, since they are both strongly adhering to Wahhabism and Salafism through the madrasa schools that were established in Pakistan during the Cold War. And these schools were financed by the West and by the Persian Gulf states. So we see the implications of it back then, and we do see it now as terrorist groups are expanding their presence in Afghanistan. And that obviously should be perceived with high suspicion, as it poses an existential threat to neighboring countries, for Iran and Central Asian Republics in particular. So there are no beneficiaries when terrorists gain more foothold in Afghanistan. Let me be very clear about that. The opposite is in fact the case. The terrorist group Daesh enjoys financial and moral support from the Persian Gulf states, as well as the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Daesh failed miserably in Syria and Iraq due to the Iranian and Russian efforts, but we already saw that the Afghan Defense Ministry, who was logistically supported by the United States, utilized military helicopters to replace Daesh elements from the south to the north of the country. And it seems that the outside powers still have a stake in supporting terrorists to advance their geopolitical objectives in Central Asia and beyond. And that indeed poses a great threat. Moreover, historically, the Afghan National Army was dissolved when jihadi groups came to power. And after that, the country did not have a strong defensive force that could defend the country against potential threats or potential terrorist groups. Pakistan, for its part, played a huge role in abolishing the, an army that was capable of defending the country's border against outside threats or against external threats. And that, unfortunately, is not the case anymore. We have a very weak army, and we have porous borders which could be easily penetrated by outsiders.
Now, Mr. Ariyoye, Taliban came back to power last year after 20 years of foreign military occupation with a promise to ensure security of all ethnic minorities. Now, is it fair to say that the group has failed to live up to that promise?
Oh, absolutely. The Taliban was primarily responsible for the security vacuum in the last 20 years. They were conducting what they coined as a holy war against the infidels. And the Taliban, a priori, willingly and knowingly, were not interested in bringing a perpetual peace and security to the country. They never really had any such aims to begin with. The Taliban were included in so-called reconciliation efforts by former Western-backed government headed by Karzai and Ahmadzai, the latter two of which explicitly designated the Taliban as their dissatisfied brothers, quote-unquote, and tried hard to bring them at the expense of the lives of many unknown numbers of innocent compatriots within the Afghan political spectrum. The Taliban were bolstered by the two aforementioned puppet presidents and formally came to power by means of a quid pro quo as established by Zalmay Khalilzad in the failed state of Afghanistan. So the Taliban, as well as Ashraf Ghani Ahmadzai, were never genuinely interested in an inclusive government. Their attitude towards the Persian speakers of Afghanistan is shocking, to say the least. In fact, to that end, policies were conducted to diminish the influence of the Persian language in Afghanistan. And today's Taliban is pretty much a reminiscent of the era of Hafiz al-Amin. And Hafiz al-Amin was a Pashtun nationalist who was responsible for the death of thousands of predominantly Tajiks as well as Hazaras, and he was eventually assassinated by the Soviets. However, many former Pashtun nationalist leaders forming an integral part of the former Haki party are now a part of the Taliban, so you can pretty much compare that the way in which former Ba'athist generals in Iraq formed an integral part of the of ISIS, and pretty much the same unfortunately happened in Afghanistan, and we see that now coming into fruition. But this subject should be discussed in another segment, I guess, but the Taliban has not and will not live up to its promise, that's for sure. They too are an instrument for outside powers. They do not, by any stretch of the imagination, operate autonomously, and they still have ties with the Pakistani ISI and other foreign intelligence services.
One last question, Mr. Ariyoye. Why don't we see any significant coverage of Daesh crimes in Afghanistan in the Western media? And why Afghan lives, well, it seems like this, why Afghan lives don't matter to them?
Absolutely. It's really important to understand that Western mainstream media, their modus operandi is very, very predicated on a very selective approach. So I think one should be very accurate as, on closer inspection at least, not only is the issue of Daesh and Taliban crimes objectively absent in Western mainstream media, but it looks like that we see a repetition of parallel events. I can recall how some terrorists were branded as moderates, whereas others were destined to be the arch enemy of the forces trying to contain them. In retrospect, it was nothing but a poor attempt to prolong a conflict and thereby stoking more violence, culminating in the disintegration of a sovereign state. And we see the same being played out again in Afghanistan, because historically Syria and the former Democratic Republic of Afghanistan are without a doubt cases in point to show how terrorists are actually utilized or instrumentalized by Western media in order to demonize a government that is not prone to the collective West. Daesh and the Taliban are two pieces of the same cake, which both have served outside forces in the past and will most likely do so in the future. Therefore, there is no need to receive bad media coverage unless they should serve as a pretext for never-ending wars and bloodshed. And that is the explanation that I can give on that point.
There you have it, Mr. Ariyoyi. It's always great to have you here on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
UK-based university researcher Rabia Khan notes a slow but steady shift in language, with words such as massacre and attack being replaced by genocide, and Shia with Hazara, after recent attacks against the Hazara community in Afghanistan. Bharat Ali Batur, a photographer and filmmaker, urges the international community, United Nations and other entities, to move beyond hollow statements of condemnation on the genocide of Hazara Shias in Afghanistan. Afghan-Australian scholar and author Farhunde Akbar says the latest attack is part of genocidal campaign against Hazaras, as targeting youth in educational centers has become a salient feature of Hazara genocide.
And that was our episode about the Indian government's crackdown on Muslim political organizations and the genocide of Afghanistan's persecuted Hazara Shia community. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take great care. Allah, Allah,
Allah, Allah. این چیزی که انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth. Allah ya Allah subhanallah. Allah ya Allah walhamdulillah.
This is a part of political divine will of the founder of Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini. My explanation does not dwell on the transcendental, spiritual, or mystical aspects of Thaghaleyn. It is a domain, the cognition of which covers all circles of being from earth to heaven and beyond to his divine presence, including circles that lie beyond our comprehension.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all over the world. You're listening to Spring of the Truth from IRIB English Radio, and this is your humble host, Zainab Mousavi. In this program, we will discuss and elaborate on Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi's viewpoints in regards to the station of the mother. In one of his speeches, he holds that no occupation is more honorable than motherhood. And again, in another speech, he says and emphasizes the great station of mother with this sentence: "You ladies enjoy the honor of motherhood and you exceed men in such honor." Imam Khomeini's views are just in accordance to Islam and Quran's teaching, and he descends motherhood so noble and so respectable that he believes that through such an honor women can exceed men. You know, motherhood is sacred because not only a mother brings her child to this world, but also provides the set and foundation for him or her to build in the future. And the love of the mother is so unconditional and undeserved that for a mother, it does not matter whether her child is a sick or healthy one, bad or good one, weak or strong one, and even young or old one. So let's have a short break and then I will explain it more. Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi. صلى الله عليه صلى Okay, welcome back. We're talking about one of the speeches of the great founder of Iranian Revolution, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. I was saying that Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh's view about the love and sacrifice of the mothers is so precise, and he sets a great difference and even considers women to be supreme over men due to their ability of being a mother. We all have heard about the famous quote from Rasulullah Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi that paradise lies beneath the feet of mothers. And this hadith, just like Imam Khomeini's precious words, signifies the greatness and honor of motherhood. Even in Quran, we have the 15th verse of Surah Al-Ahqaf about this issue. And Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says that his mother has carried him in pain and bore him in pain, and his gestation and weaning takes 30 months. All these views represent the great position of a mother. So do not forget to respect your mothers if they are alive, and in case they have passed away, I ask God's mercy and blessings to be with them. Thank you for listening to us. I bid you farewell. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm your host, Zainab Askari. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions, and issues that parents have regarding the Islamic upbringing of their children. The answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have with us our guest speaker, Professor Salman Nakavi, who's a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University in the Hausa Ilmi of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, since parents play a major role in the Islamic upbringing of their children, so for that reason, parents themselves need to have a lot of knowledge. We discussed a little about it, but I would want you to summarize what kind of knowledge, what should parents have in themselves first as the guiders of their children.
Yes, in the name of Allah, I begin my discussion today. Let me bring forward a point that should have been mentioned earlier. When we talk about upbringing or carrying out any activity within the worldview and ideology of Islam as a Muslim parent, it's obvious that when we're talking about upbringing, it has to be according to Islamic principles and values.
True.
So there's no need to qualify that upbringing by saying it's Islamic upbringing. That's very important. I mean, yes, many of our activities we attribute to them and qualify them to be Islamic. It's obvious as a Muslim person, as a Muslim parent, whatever we should do, whatever we do should be done with this purpose in mind, that we want to achieve the proximity to God, Allah Almighty, and therefore it should be Islamic. But again, we do qualify it to be Islamic because we want to negate any other form of upbringing which may be done with a materialistic mindset. So basically, the parent should know what he is dealing with, what she is dealing with, what is the responsibility that he or she has to carry out as a Muslim believer, as a faithful person, as an educator. Basically, he should have, or she should have, an understanding of those six elements that we talked about in education.
Yeah.
Whether it's formal education or it's informal education, those six elements are there.
Yeah.
Of course, all of us may have a vague understanding, something which is there hidden in our minds, but it has to be brought out and understood properly in a concrete manner. We have to be able to determine the elements of education. So a parent or any educator for that matter should know who he is dealing with, who she is dealing with, where do we start off from, what is the starting point of that education and upbringing, where should it end.
And it should they should also have a knowledge about the one whom they are teaching, upbringing.
The person who's being taught brought up should be known. The environment, the environment through that learning has to take place.
True. We'll talk more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Nakavi, and we are discussing how parents can do Islamic upbringing of their children, but in a better way, while they themselves have some important points in them, like they should have knowledge about themselves first, they should have knowledge about their children, and many more elements Professor Naqvi is talking about. Yes.
So, as I was saying, the six elements of education have to be known and understood by the person who is going to carry out that training and upbringing and education as a whole.
Yeah.
And the first and foremost thing would be knowing and understanding oneself.
Yeah.
And what competencies one has, what the knowledge base he or she has to have,
okay.
the skills
okay.
that one has to have, the attitude, which is very important.
Okay.
As I said, as Muslim parents, as Muslim believers and practitioners, there's no doubt that everything has to be done within the bounds of religion.
True.
We have to remove and get done with that secular mindset that we have. That is a very basic problem in our lives, in our societies today.
Okay.
When we talk about Islam, we compare it with other systems. I mean, there's no comparison to be made, but we still do it. We talk about banking, Islamic banking, conventional banking. So, I mean, that conventional banking is non-Islamic, so it's not according to the design that Allah Almighty has made for our lives. So when it comes to upbringing children, we have to do it for the sake of Allah.
Okay.
For the sake of Allah means doing it how he wants us to do it. For the sake of Allah means that it has to be with a pure intention.
Yeah.
It has to be for the sake of bringing forward to life and to bring up a person in the Islamic context, in the Islamic tradition, with the Islamic goals in mind, with the principles as the basis of that life that one has to have, that pure life, the hayat-e tayyibah that one has to lead to be successful in this world and the hereafter. So the important thing that the parent, the educator, the trainer must know
yep.
that he should have the proper knowledge,
all right.
he should have the proper attitude,
mm-hmm.
and he should have the proper skills.
All right.
The psychomotor skills, how to manage, how to communicate, how to interact with the child.
All right.
So these are the basic things that the educator must know about himself and then, of course, about the child and the other factors and elements which are there.
True. The first thing we get to know that as educator, a person needs to understand self. He needs to understand the competencies and skills, the psychomotor skills and attitude, his own attitude, the attitude of a child. All these elements should be known on both sides, as an educator himself and as parent or even in the child. So the qualities or the elements that you said an educator must have, does it mean that only a parent should have these qualities or even the teacher at school? We'll discuss more on that after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said, "Honor your children and teach them good manners."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. I'm with Professor Naqvi, and we are discussing about the elements an educator should have for the necessary upbringing of a child. Well, Professor Naqvi, before the break, we asked you, is it enough that only a parent has these elements that we discussed, or even the trainer at schools or at some gym or any other place?
Actually, your question should be the other way around. Yes, a teacher, a trainer, a coach, he or she must have these elements. The problem is that when it comes to parenting, we think, though, no, it's something going to happen naturally.
Yeah.
I mean, once we've got married, everything comes naturally. Whereas, as a matter of fact, there's a great deal of learning to be done to become a parent. And before that, even becoming a couple.
Yeah.
I mean, a person has to become be able to recognize and determine for himself or herself the spouse.
Yeah.
And then go on to the other
stages. So the upbringing starts at a very, very early stage, before even the child is born.
As an educator, one has to be very clear that is he going to live a life of complacency and normality as the society moves, or we have a mission in life.
Yeah.
We as the followers of the Ahlul Bayt,
do have a goal.
We have a goal. We have a principle. We believe in wilaya. We believe in the principle of the imamate.
Yeah.
We have a mission, a goal in life.
Yeah, reaching perfection.
Reaching perfection and bringing about that perfection in life, in society. Developing
in all
society.
Actions.
Everything should be for that sake. It should be a mission. It should be a continuous struggle.
True.
A jihad,
yeah.
in the true sense. So this is the mindset that the parent should have. Of course, the teacher in an Islamic state, in an Islamic system, the teacher, the coach, even physical training,
mm-hmm.
which would be for that purpose, that we want to develop strong people, have strong minds, and become companions of the imam, awaited imam. That is the most important thing, that we have a mission state. It's not that we just teach our children to pray for the imam,
yeah.
and that's all, and then go on with their everyday lives as they would be doing in any other society or in any other community or any other part of the world.
All right.
No, we have to create, we have to develop, we have to bring up soldiers of the imam.
True.
That is the mission statement that we have to have. So we can't be, we can't have a very relaxed behavior in the upbringing of our children. It has to be a continuous struggle. It has to be a continuous learning process.
True.
We need to learn something before. Of course, it's very true that till you don't get involved in that relationship, the man and wife as a couple, many things are theoretical.
Yeah.
But there has to be theoretical learning before that, premarital and then pre-parenting.
Mm-hmm.
We have to know some things, understand things, and then when we come to the implementation and application of those theoretical issues, there is how we have to manage things and go back to a person whom we consider as a mentor, maybe as a guide, go back to him, discuss
yeah.
with him. So it should be a continuous learning process, and a process where we are teaching and taking our knowledge and skills level to a higher stage and a higher level continuously.
All right. So when we said that an educator must have all those elements, we mean that it should not be like he should not be educating himself just after a child is born. These all things, the elements he needs to have, the skills, the education, the understanding, the cognitive skills or psychomotor skills, all the things he needs to have, the competence and all, he should be having that before he gets into a relationship.
Exactly.
Basically, not just after the child is born. Thank you so much, Professor Naqavi, for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah. God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
Economic divide.
The Ukraine conflict is over 9 months old, yet the U.S. is leading Europe down the war path with Russia. And for as much as the European economies continue to suffer, one country is benefiting from the crisis. That country, the U.S. Is it knowingly pushing Europe down this path to make out on things like energy sales? Hi, I'm Kaveh Tahlai. Welcome to Economic Divide. Coming up in today's programs, Europe's economy is taking a beating. UK's new tax plan slammed. Germany's double-digit inflation is beating also down the economies, including the EU inflation standing at 10%. That is not good news for Europe as a whole. Then, taking a look at the Nord Stream sabotage, the gas pipeline was damaged. A Polish politician thanked the U.S. Russia blames the U.S. in turn, though not directly. Who would benefit from this? Many say the U.S. would, because the U.S. President Joe Biden did say that prior to the Ukraine conflict. Then, focuses on U.S. dubious plans, dragging the war for its own benefit. Is it guilty of that? Tax incentives for EU companies to relocate to the U.S. is one reason. As a result, Europe's deindustrialization is taking place.
As the war drags on in East Europe, the European Union is beginning to emerge as the biggest economic loser of the war. The bloc was already battered by 2 years of economic recession, which was triggered by the COVID-19 crisis. But the Union is now having to cope with surging energy prices amid a standoff with Russia.
When it comes to online posts on this topic, there were many because it covers quite a vast array of topics, from the European economies and the countries in the 27-member bloc to Russia, to the Ukraine conflict, and of course the role that the U.S. plays in all of this. Our first post is about Germany. Germany will fall far from its throne in the Eurozone economy and will not be able to return as current energy-triggered industrial shutdowns add to the hollowing out that was already underway as big manufacturers redeployed, now hastened by need to decouple with China. Next is also about Germany. I think many Germans don't realize how the energy crisis directly threatens Germany's future as a prosperous country. Germany has a huge bureaucracy and social welfare apparatus and provides comparatively generous subsidies for the arts. Next up, when push comes to shove over Taiwan, the U.S. will not hesitate to ruin the economies of Japan and South Korea in order to do damage to China, just as it is now sacrificing the EU's economy to strangulate Russia. Then the Germans shall not loathe themselves anymore as the USA and London destroyed a vital pipeline for Europe. It is time for Germans to rediscover their Prussian spirit that made them the envy of Europe. Next up, Denmark and Sweden. They are saying that the Nord Stream pipelines were damaged by a blast that was equal to hundreds of pounds of explosives. The Euros are playing a fun game where they have to investigate who did this while knowing that it was likely the U.S., but they aren't allowed to say that. And more on the blast on the Nord Stream. Nord Stream blast equal to several hundred kilos of TNT. Reports have indicated that the four leaks affecting the Nord Stream gas pipelines in the Baltic Sea were caused by underwater explosions corresponding to hundreds of kilograms of explosive, based on a Danish-Swedish report. It said the magnitude of the explosion was measured at 2.3 and 2.1 on the Richter scale, respectively, probably corresponding to an explosive load of several hundred kilos. This is what the two countries said in a joint report to the UN Security Council. Of course, what good does that do? The UN convenes, but yet nothing is done about it, really. At this point, no follow-through investigations are still somewhat at a standstill at this point. Our guest joining us for the first segment of the Q&A. First, we have Vladimir Goldstein joins us. Vladimir Goldstein is the professor of Slavic studies who joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Vladimir Goldstein, welcome. Taking a look at these pipeline explosions that have happened, all eyes are on the U.S. for an explanation because the U.S. president had said prior to the Ukraine conflict that it would do that. Is the U.S. guilty of it?
The question is about pipeline and who benefits from that and who's done that. We really see that country, the only country which will benefit from that, outside, of course, Ukraine, which has very myopic short-term interest, is the United States. They have been very much interested in splitting and driving a wedge between Russia and Europe, and a pipeline and, you know, gas, cheap gas, is one of the very, you know, means of connecting these two, these two parts of economic equation. So United States is very much interested in separating them, and they've been interested in that for a long time. If you watch the news, they've been against this any kind of pipeline. You know, Russia tries to do a pipeline through the south. No, Russia tries to do the pipeline all around Ukraine. No. Why? Because Ukraine is the only place which United States fully control, and they can stop the pipeline from working through Ukraine if they want to. So that was their interest, to stop the pipeline going. And finally, they used this opportunity of the war to put an end to that. They were threatening, they were pushing the Germany, they were trying to stop it by peaceful means. It didn't work out. Now they did it through military means, whether it's the United States itself or through some proxies, like maybe they hired Poles or Ukrainians, we don't know. But that's the only country which is interested in that, and the only country with means. So they have means, they have opportunity, because Russia didn't have opportunity to do these things in Baltics. Baltics are very much controlled by all NATO equipment, by all things, so Russians didn't, even if they wanted to, there is no reason for them to want it after they invested billions of dollars in that. But, you know, Russians just couldn't do that. United States had motive, had opportunity, and had very much interest in it. So no doubt about that, they benefit from it.
All right, let me introduce our next guest for this program. Mousami Makhboul joins us, founder of the Rumi Center for Global Peace, which runs advocacy projects for peace and sustainability. Great cause. He has been associated with the World Bank, the UNDP, the UNAOC, and also for UNICEF, mostly working and advocating for Rohingya refugees. Mousami Makhboul, welcome to Economic Divide. We're advocating for Rohingya refugees, obviously, is a great cause. But taking a look at the Ukraine conflict and a process that's happening in Europe called deindustrialization, how do you assess that? I mean, what are we looking at? Is that actually what is going on when it comes to Europe, in particular relocating to the U.S. in terms of its factories?
Well, it has been recently confirmed by World Trade Organization, World Bank, as well as by World Economic Forum, and leading 22 world economists around the world, you know, have confirmed that there will be massive recession coming in 2023. The Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines have been hit, and the destruction is real, and the repairs would take more than 8 to 10 months. This would be one of the most concerning issue as of now, and you know, importing energies from U.S., which what actually the U.S. wants, you know, they want, you know, the entire Europe not to be dependent on Russia, but to have an alternative importing country as United States. So this would be again a very, very tough challenge for not only Germany but other parts of Europe as well.
The info news section is upon us, and we're going to start out with what's become now a common topic when we have had our episodes aired before. And this particular one is about what's ahead when it comes to the EU and the winter. Now, the Energy Commissioner is warning of a difficult winter amid the energy crisis there. The EU is saying this winter is going to be very hard, but the next one will even be worse in terms of what is going to happen. And the EU itself is admitting to that. So it's kind of preparing the population to be prepared for what's upcoming this winter and maybe even the next. On to our next piece of news. This piece of news is really important in so many ways. Geopolitics of the world may have gotten a shock in terms of how there has been a resistance against the West, and in particular the U.S., which leads NATO. And basically this is about the new Russian territories, where it happened through a referendum. These Ukrainian territories joined Russia. It was considered a major win for Putin. Western leaders reacting. The U.S. will help Ukraine regain control, but we haven't seen that happen as of yet. There has been one particular region within these territories that Ukraine has taken control. But the reason for this to be part of the Info News section is to highlight how Russia is standing against the Western aggression. And of course, that itself has economic repercussions. Next up, a topic again that we've covered, but it's really important, is concerning the economy of the UK and what Liz Truss, the new Prime Minister, has done. She's been slammed for the new tax cut scheme that she has introduced. One of the side effects, the rich are going to benefit over the poor. And that's not good for the UK as a whole or any other country. She is focusing on what is known as trickle-down economics, but many analysts and economists alike have said that's not going to work. Since we've talked about the UK economy, next up we're going to take a look at the US economy for our InfoNews section, in which it shrank from the months of April through till June. Now, does that mean that the US is in a recession? Well, if you have two consecutive quarters, by definition, that should constitute a recession. Yet the U.S. is not admitting to that, and it's not reflected that way in the news. Those were the topics for our InfoNews section.
Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
This is the InfoNews section of the program. We're going to try to see how the U.S. benefits from the Ukraine conflict. Well, first up, Europe's economy was battered not only before COVID, but then after the pandemic for two straight years. So it took a beating then. Now it is suffering from an energy crunch. After all, Russia provided Europe with almost 40% of its gas needs. Gone are the days when Europe could buy cheap Russian gas, which has vanished from European markets. Now, given that, that spells bad news for many European factories where lack of natural gas is hindering industrial operations. So that's a big factor there. So bad is the situation with the factories across the 27-member bloc that many are forced to shut down. Well, in essence, since there is a European-wide energy crisis, many are looking to not only quit the continent, but to shift the production elsewhere. Did you ask where they are relocating to? That country is the U.S. Does that surprise you? Yes, such is the case. The U.S. is emerging as a destination for European companies looking to get out of the crisis-ridden European Union. That's right. Well, don't take our word for it. Our source was the Wall Street Journal, which said amid Europe's energy crisis, manufacturers are actually shifting to the U.S.
A big winner is emerging from Europe's energy crisis, and it's the U.S. economy. As the Ukraine war drives up European energy costs, a number of European manufacturers are being lured to the relative stability of the United States.
Now, here's a question for you. Do you think it's a coincidence that the U.S., for example, recently passed what's called the U.S. Inflation Reduction Act? One of the goals of this act was meant to lure European companies into the U.S. Is it beginning to sink in now? And that is what has happened. The European branch of the steel company ArcelorMittal, car maker Volkswagen, you have the Pandora, Danish jeweler, just three of those have relocated to the U.S. That's a jewelry company, and chemical maker OCI. Again, just a few of the factories that have relocated to the U.S. Meanwhile, what has been Europe's solution? It has reacted by setting aside 500 billion euros. That's right, 500 billion euros to cushion the energy crisis. But is that enough? And more importantly, will it work? Well, let's get an analysis into all of these points if we possibly can. Let me reintroduce our guest who's rejoining us for this. Vladimir Goldstein, professor of Slovak studies from Providence, Rhode Island, joins us. Vladimir, welcome back. Some of the accusations are flying around about the U.S. to actually deliberately be dragging this war out because it has many advantages for the U.S.